Hello everyone, it's Helena here in Truro, here with part 4 of my podcast on the Taking of Christ by Caravaggio. In parts 2 and 3, we looked at Giotto's masterpiece of the same subject, and in this recording, we'll focus on Caravaggio's. When you look at both paintings, it's easy to see why they're often brought into comparison, because there are a number of striking differences between the two works. Here are the most notable. Perhaps the most obvious is that whereas Giotto gives us a fairly comprehensive account of the narrative, including the subplots as well as the main storyline, Caravaggio gives us a heavily edited version of events by paring the narrative down to its bare essentials and eliminating all peripheral characters. Another clear difference concerns the scale of the drama. In Giotto's work, you get a real sense of the multitude of people who'd come to arrest Christ. The hornblower implying a call to arms, a real battle taking place between the forces of good and evil. And it's a battle on an epic scale, such as you might find in a movie directed by David Lean or Steven Spielberg or Christopher Nolan. By contrast, Caravaggio's work is more low-key, parochial. More like a nighttime raid by the local police, or spuri, who've come to break up a fight between rival gangs and arrest the ringleaders. And then there's the difference of proximity. Giotto may permit his finger-pointing high priest to rub his left arm against the membrane of the canvas, suggesting he's near to us, nudging into our space. But in general, he respects the barrier between the picture plane and the area occupied by the viewer. He makes you feel engaged in the drama, but it is just that. It's like a play being performed on a somewhat remote stage, where the actors are shown full length, but none in close-up. With Caravaggio, we're up close and personal. So close, we can feel ourselves being jostled by the crowd. And so close, we can see our reflection in the shiny, metal-clad arm of the soldier moving forward to arrest Christ. It's like being in one of those intimate cinemas with lots of close-up shots. Or, actually there. Not just spectating, but participating in the events taking place. Which is just the experience Caravaggio wants us to feel. Then there's a difference of setting. Giotto implies nighttime through the presence of the torchbearers, but he actually gives us a daytime scene with lots of bright colours and a vibrant blue sky, whereas Caravaggio most definitely gives us a nighttime scene with darkness and yet more darkness. And indeed that chiaroscuro, that contrast between light and shade, and in its starkest form such as here, known as tenebrism, is a key, if not the key feature of the painting, because it reinforces the drama of the narrative and its realism and immediacy and underpins its spiritual meaning. Then there's the difference of background. Giotto gives us weapons and torches set against the bright blue sky, and the sky gives a real sense of space and depth to the painting. Whereas Caravaggio gives us no background, only darkness. And a darkness that makes the figures project even more forcefully out into our space, giving them an uncanny sense of realism and presence. Another area of contrast concerns the depiction of Christ. Giotto presents Christ as the Son of God, with his golden halo and noble pose and profile. Whereas Caravaggio presents the human side of Christ, a man expressing sorrow at having been betrayed by one of his closest friends, and signs of fear as he faces the prospect of his death. Caravaggio gives no clear signs of Christ's divinity, although, as we'll see, he gives more subtle, clever alternatives. And so, aside from the obvious difference in style and technique, there are indeed a number of differences between the two works. And yet, as I mentioned in my introduction, what I find so astonishing is how powerfully both paintings speak to the viewer. Both works are equally strong in the fields of drama and emotion. And the reason why this is so, I believe, is because both artists passionately share a common vision. They both agree that the emotional core of this story is the betrayal of Christ, an innocent man, by one of his closest friends. And they want the interaction between Judas and Christ to be the main focus of our attention. Also, both artists seek to capture for all time the most dramatic moment in the story. And they both agree that that moment is to be found within the encounter between Judas and Christ. Where they differ is their selection of the precise moment. For Giotto, it's the moment before Judas kisses Christ. For Caravaggio, it's the moment immediately after. And yet, both artists present a Christ who has foreknowledge of Judas's betrayal. And they both present a Judas reacting to his realization of Christ's foreknowledge. It's a fiercely intense psychological interaction between the two men, conveyed with such power and conviction by both artists. And that's the reason why I believe, despite the differences between the two paintings, we can find ourselves reacting with the same emotional strength to both works. Now, in parts 2 and 3, we explored Giotto's interpretation of the encounter between the two men. And in this part, we'll shortly look at Caravaggio's. But let's start with an overview of the painting. It measures approximately 134 by 170 centimetres. So it's smaller than its companion piece, the Supper at Emmaus, which is 141 by 196 centimetres. While we can't know for sure, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that at least initially, the two paintings would have been hung side by side for purposes of comparison and contrast. And I'll refer to some features in The Taking of Christ, which may have been compared with the earlier work at the appropriate point in the commentary. But let's now turn to the painting itself. What do we see? Well, for a start, we have 7 figures. 7 compared with Giotto's 20 or more. And these figures, shown from left to right, are a fleeing disciple, usually identified as St. John the Evangelist, Christ, Judas, 3 soldiers, and in between the 2nd and 3rd soldier, a lantern bearer, which is a self-portrait of the artist. Caravaggio has closely cropped the picture, so he sacrifices the full-length figures in order to give us close-up shots of Judas, Christ, St. John, and the lantern bearer. The faces of the soldiers are very much hidden beneath their helmets. In Giotto's work, the clusters of helmets imply the presence of many more soldiers than we actually see. In Caravaggio's work, under special lighting conditions, lances are just visible at the top right-hand corner of the painting. And this implies there are more soldiers following the ones that are shown in the painting. And this is where Caravaggio uses darkness as a very clever editing tool. Whatever he wants to exclude from the painting, he hides in the shadows. In The Taking of Christ, Caravaggio very cleverly combines and condenses the 3 main incidents in the narrative: the betrayal of Christ by Judas, the arrest of Christ by the soldiers, and the flight of the disciples. And with a heavily reduced cast in his drama, he has some of the characters doubling up on parts, and some of the features have multi-layered meanings. We'll look at each figure in turn in a moment, but I'd like to conclude this overview of the painting with drawing your attention to what I consider to be the 2 most striking features of the painting. The first is the powerful use of darkness, and the second is the proximity that the viewer experiences to the characters in the drama and the action taking place. With reference to the darkness, Caravaggio took his cue from St. John's version of the story. where there are references to lanterns and torches. So a clear indication that the scene is set at night time. But it isn't just to give the painting historical authenticity. As I mentioned earlier, Caravaggio uses the darkness to strengthen the drama of the scene, its emotional intensity, its realism and immediacy, and to underpin its spiritual meaning. And the link between darkness and spirituality is particularly important in this painting, because darkness and light are among the most commonly used metaphors in the Bible. Darkness standing for evil and death, and light for goodness and life. There are constant references in the Bible to people hiding their evil deeds in the darkness, contrasted with verses referring to people letting their good works shine in the light. So darkness really adds mood and atmosphere to this painting. It implies that something sinister, something evil is taking place, suggesting that through the arrest of Christ, an injustice is being committed. And certainly Christians would argue that Christ was innocent of the charges brought against him. Visitors to the National Gallery of Ireland in Dublin, where this painting hangs, are often asked how they react to the painting. And a common response is that it reminds them of the arrest of a political dissident by the secret police, who has been critical of the state and arrested on trumped-up charges. And these arrests often take place at night time. And because there have been a number of arrests that fall into this category in recent years, this painting seems to have particular resonance with modern society. It seems to be as relevant today as the period to which it relates to and the time in which it was painted. However, in his reference to darkness, Caravaggio wasn't just drawing upon a biblical metaphor. He was also relating to personal experience. He knew all too well what it was like to be pursued by the authorities, to be arrested at night. The difference is that whereas Christ was innocent, Caravaggio was invariably guilty of the charges brought against him. And he also knew that darkness could be a criminal's best friend. An early description of the artist by a barber surgeon indicates that Caravaggio was quite scruffy in appearance. His clothing was worn and shabby, and significantly, black. And there was a very good reason behind this sartorial choice. In an age before there was proper street lighting, Caravaggio knew that if he was being pursued by the authorities, he could literally disappear into the shadows. Dark clothing was nighttime camouflage. A person dressed in black signified someone who was up to no good, had something to hide. So in his art, just as in his life, whatever Caravaggio did not want to show, he hid in shadow. And the powerful tool of darkness is closely connected to the second striking feature of this painting. And that is the sense of proximity on the part of the viewer to the characters in the drama and involvement in the action taking place. In my podcast on the Supper at Emmaus, I explained how Renaissance artists respected the boundary between the picture plane and the viewer's space. But in the imaginary world of the picture, they created, through the use of perspective and landscape, a sense of space in which their characters could freely move. I went on to explain how Caravaggio challenged and reversed that principle. He replaced backgrounds with barriers in the form of a wall or a dark void. So the people in his paintings have nowhere to go but forward, challenging or entering our space, breaking down the barrier between the world of the picture and the world of the viewer. And that is why the people in Caravaggio's paintings have such an uncanny sense of presence and realism about them. In the Supper at Emmaus, the outflung arms of the astonished disciple, together with the arm of Christ blessing the food on the table, serve as measuring tools to help us estimate how close we are, in theory, to the suppertime guests. In the taking of Christ, we don't need a ruler. We're millimetres away from the action. So close, we can see our reflection in the shiny armour of the soldier arresting Christ, a reflection which then becomes distorted by the steam of our own breath. We're that close, uncomfortably close, because Caravaggio wants us fully engaged in this drama, involved as well as interested, and implicated too. Like it or not, we're on the side of the soldiers, on the side of the enemies of Christ. We may seek to condemn them, but we're just as much implicated in the guilt of their actions. As I explained in my talk about Giotto, it's a natural conclusion of Christian theology that if Christians believe that Christ came to die for the salvation of the whole of humankind, for not only his own generation, but past generations and generations to come, and sin was the reason for his death, then we, as sinful humans, are just as responsible for his condemnation and death as his contemporaries were. And this is reinforced by the fact that whereas Caravaggio shows Christ, Judas and John wearing timeless biblical robes, he places the soldiers and the lantern bearer in dress of his own time, establishing an association, therefore, between the historical enemies of Christ and a contemporary audience. So whoever stands in front of this painting is equally implicated in the crime. It's an uneasy, uncomfortable association. But then Caravaggio was never in the business of producing comforting, reassuring paintings. Whereas Giotto implies this guilt association with his audience somewhat gently and subtly, Caravaggio drives home the argument with much greater force. Now let's have a look at each figure in turn, starting with the left-hand side. First, we have the profile of a beardless young man. It's a disturbing vision. His arms are flung wide before him as he appears to be fleeing from the scene. He wears an expression of utter terror, his eyes and mouth open wide, and the open mouth suggesting that his flight is accompanied by a loud, ear-piercing scream. Above and behind him billows his cloak, which a soldier has grabbed in an attempt to prevent his escape. And this red cloak gives the impression of creating a circle within the profiles of himself, Judas and Christ, providing a frame like a picture within a picture, helping us focus on the interaction between Judas and Christ, which is at the heart of the narrative. Now, this young disciple forms a dual function. On the one hand, he stands for all the disciples who have fled the scene, as described in both Matthew and Mark's account of the story. It reinforces the pathos of the scene, that Christ has been abandoned at the hour of his greatest need by all his closest friends. And yet their flight is welcomed and blessed by Christ, because in John's Gospel, before Christ's arrest, he prays to his Father for the protection, deliverance and safety of all the disciples, because their survival is crucial to the founding and growth of the Christian Church. For if the disciples are taken with Christ and subsequently executed, who will remain to bear witness to his resurrection and spread the good news of the gospel? So this is a crucial point in Christ's ministry. He gives his blessing not just to the flight of the disciples, but the founding of the Christian Church after his death. And then more specifically, this figure is identified with a young man dressed in a linen tunic in St. Mark's Gospel, who, in his panic to evade arrest, drops his garment and runs away naked from the scene. And we've seen in Giotto's work how this incident is referred to through the stocky-looking man with his back towards us, who is grabbing at the garment of a man who's shown off stage, outside of the picture frame. In Caravaggio's work, the young man is fully clothed, probably for reasons of decorum, but the fact that his cloak is being grabbed by one of the soldiers implies that it is the figure in St. Mark's Gospel that Caravaggio has in mind. And this person is usually associated with St. John the Evangelist. And there are features in this painting which suggest that Caravaggio goes along with this argument. By tradition, St. John is the youngest of the disciples, and that would account for him being shown beardless in the painting. In art, this is a traditional convention used to imply youth. In paintings, St. John is often depicted wearing red and green robes, the colours also used in this painting. Also, John was regarded as the disciple most loved by Christ. And we know this because John tells us so in his gospel. Modesty was clearly not his strongest virtue. And this provides an interesting juxtaposition, having to Christ's right-hand side his most loyal and loving disciple, standing as a counterpoint to the figure to Christ's left, Judas the betrayer, the most disloyal and hateful of all the disciples. And the strong bond of friendship and love between John and Christ is reinforced by the way they are standing back to back, head to head, as though they're glued together, and their overlapping strands of hair, almost identical in shade, gives the appearance of them melding into one person, and it increases the pathos of the scene, that Christ, in his greatest hour of need, is abandoned by his most faithful and loving disciple. But as with the other disciples, John's escape is of paramount importance, because not only will his survival enable him to testify to Christ's resurrection and to play his part in the missionary activity of the early church, but he will also be able to make a record of the life and ministry of Christ in the form of the fourth gospel, arguably the most philosophical of all the gospel texts, as well as his vision of the Last Judgment in the book of Revelation. That is why only one of his hands is visible in this painting, and prominently so. It is his right hand, or more specifically, his writing hand. So a reference to his future profession, which is safeguarded by his flight from the scene. From this perspective, we can view his departure in a different way. Instead of viewing it as a flight prompted by fear from a scene of danger, we can see him as running towards his new destiny, his role as a recorder, protagonist and protector of the Christian faith. And yet I think it would be wrong to dismiss the disturbing vision of the terrified face of this young man. If you look at the way that John is positioned in this painting, it's very strange. It's as though he's coming out of Christ, an expression, if you like, of his inner spirit. And I think Caravaggio wants us to see him in this way, as the outward expression of Christ's inner turmoil and anguish. He may feel these emotions very strongly, but is unable to give vent to them. In the Synoptic Gospels version of the Garden of Gethsemane scene, the one preceding Christ's betrayal and arrest, Christ begins his prayers with a request for deliverance from the suffering that lies ahead. But having been reassured by a vision, he concludes his prayers with resolution to submit to his Father's will, continue on the path to the cross, and see the fulfillment of the scriptures. And as we'll see when we study the figure of Christ in more detail, particularly his hands, we'll see that this is the Christ presented to us by Caravaggio, a man who is resolute, stoical, obedient to the will of his Father, willing to surrender to the authorities, even though he knows this will lead to his torture and execution, and, while capable anger, willing to do this without resort to violence. And he can do this, indeed he must do this, because he is the Son of God, and it is his purpose on earth to fulfill the will of his Father and bring salvation to the world. But he is also human, and what makes his sacrifice all the more incredible and wonderful to Christians is that he was able to do this while still experiencing the very human emotions of doubt, of fear, sorrow, anger, loneliness, and pain. We can't see those suppressed feelings, but they are brilliantly visualized and vocalized for us by Caravaggio, through the screaming, terrified figure of St. John. And no doubt the dramatic gestures of St. John would have been compared and contrasted by guests to the Matai Palace with the similar dramatic gestures of the astonished disciple in the Supper at Emmaus painting. They would no doubt have commented on the fact that two very similar gestures were motivated by entirely different sentiments in both paintings. In the Supper at Emmaus, the outspread arms of the astonished disciple, reflecting his joyous incredulity at witnessing the miracle of Christ's resurrection. Whereas in the taking of Christ, John has flung back his arms and screamed, not in joy, but out of sheer terror and horror in witnessing the betrayal and arrest of Christ. And just as John is multifunctional in this heavily edited version of the story, so too is his billowing red cloak. On the one hand, it helps identify him as being the young man in St. Mark's Gospel who drops his garment in his panic to escape. It provides a frame around the profiles of himself, Judas and John, in order to help us focus on the key figures in this story. And in the same way that in the Supper at Emmaus, the innkeeper inadvertently provides Christ with a halo in the form of his shadow projected against the back wall. In a similar way, the billowing cloak provides Christ with a halo that he would otherwise lack. For there's no shiny gold leaf halo, as provided by Giotto in his version of the story. No, this halo is red, symbolising bloodshed, the sacrifice that Christ will make on the cross. So it symbolises his sacrificial, loving nature, as well as his divine status. What a clever device this cloak has proved to be. And yet it may not have been Caravaggio's idea. It may have been suggested by his patron, Ciriaco Mattei. And there are two theories as to where the idea came from. One of these is connected to the massive collection of antique classical sculpture that Ciriaco had amassed and displayed within the Matai Palace. Among the treasures were carved sarcophagus stones with decorations of billowing cloaks above the main figures. And these cloaks bear a strong resemblance to the one held aloft by John in the Taking of Christ painting. The second theory, which is the more plausible of the two, concerns a print that Caravaggio had in his possession, one of a stockpile that he used for ideas and inspiration. And the print was an engraving by Francesco Villamina, dated 1601, which was commissioned by Ciriaco himself. It shows a very brutal skirmish taking place on the streets of Rome between the city's pro-French and pro-Spanish factions. One of the fighters is wearing a cloak that forms a crescent shape as it billows in the wind created by his movement, and it bears such a striking resemblance to the cloak of St. John that it's highly likely that Caravaggio lifted this detail straight from the engraving and transferred it to his painting. And I think it's of significance that Caravaggio took this detail from an engraving of everyday street life, or violence, I should say, of a scene that his contemporaries could relate to, as though he envisaged the scene right from the start as a type of fracas that he personally encountered on a regular basis. A nocturnal scuffle, a street brawl, a run-in with the authorities. And he knew that his contemporaries could relate to those sort of events, whereas they might struggle trying to visualise the multitude gathered in opposition to Christ as related in the gospel narratives. And so, by drawing on his own personal experience, Caravaggio was able to produce a narrative which was much more authentic, believable, realistic, and relevant to the audience of his own time. And now we turn to the figures of Christ and Judas. Aside from Giotto, I don't think any other artist who tackled this subject has achieved the same degree of psychological depth that Caravaggio did in depicting the encounter between Judas and Christ. the powerful way in which Caravaggio manages to reveal the intensity of the two men's emotional state is simply breathtaking. Let's look first of all at Christ. Christ reveals his foreknowledge of Judas's betrayal in the way that he reacts to the disciples' kiss of greeting. Had he been unaware of Judas's intentions, he would have no doubt responded in kind, met Judas's kiss with one of his own. But instead, he flinches at the gesture, turns his head away, and we see that his eyes are downcast in a state of intense grief and sorrow. There's no sign of anger, no disgust, no bitterness towards Judas for what he has done, only intense pain and profound sorrow. This partly reflects the hurt he feels at being betrayed by one of his closest friends. And that's understandable. He is human as well as the Son of God. But the hurt goes much deeper than that. That expression reveals the great concern he feels for the welfare of his one-time friend. Because just as he knows of Judas's betrayal, he also knows of Judas's fate. That Judas will be so filled with remorse and guilt at what he has done, betrayed an innocent man and a close friend, that he will take his own life and be maligned forever in history as the bad guy, the disciple who betrayed Christ. And so instead of being preoccupied with his own concerns, Christ is reflecting with deep sadness on the bleak future that lies in store for Judas. This outpouring of understanding, compassion, forgiveness is almost like a dress rehearsal for Christ before his final supreme act of love, his sacrifice on the cross for the whole of humankind. But for me, the most masterful feature of Caravaggio's depiction of Christ concerns his hands. Look at them closely. Bathed in a pool of light, as pallid as his complexion, clasped together with the fingers intertwined, the hands are thrust forward in a gesture of resignation and restraint. It's another doubling up feature of Caravaggio's. It's a gesture of peaceful surrender and replaces Christ's rebuke to Peter for his violent behaviour. And yet if we look again at his hands, there is tenseness there in the muscles. Is it possible to detect fear in those tense muscles? Fear at the prospects of the pain and suffering that lay ahead? And fear that Caravaggio may have given visual expression to through the terrified face of John? Caravaggio never shies away from showing us Christ's humanity, his vulnerability, and the fact that Christ had to suppress all those natural feelings and emotions of fear and anxiety when facing an agonizing death, made his act of sacrifice and self-denial appear all the more wonderful to Christians. Now, it's possible that this idea of Christ's peaceful acceptance of his fate may have had a contemporary inspiration, because the middle brother of the Matthai family, Girolamo, was not only a cardinal, but a member of a strict order of monks known as Franciscan observants. The Franciscans placed the concept of abnegatio, which refers to the complete denial of self, and dedication to others at the centre of their teaching. For them, Christ's calm acceptance of cruelty and torture was a constant source to them of wonder and amazement. And so Caravaggio, presenting Christ with his hand gesture representing self-denial and resignation, was providing one of the most powerful images of that Christian ideal. And it may well have been suggested to him by Girolamo. And there is a further and fascinating link between the hand gesture of Christ in this painting and Franciscan ideals. In a previous podcast, I discussed earlier influences on Caravaggio's work. One of these was the sculptural groups of painted figures in the Sacromonte, or Sacred Mountain, in Varello. These groups showed scenes in the life of Christ and were regarded as visual aids to the spiritual discipline of visualization. This discipline, which I also refer to in my introduction, was first made popular by Francis of Assisi and his followers. The believer would visualize in their mind's eye scenes from the Bible, particularly popular with those surrounding the Passion of Christ. Then they would place themselves in the scene and meditate upon the emotions and feelings of the main characters in the drama. The purpose of these exercises was to deepen one's faith and spirituality. One of these scenes at Varallo shows the crucifixion. It includes the figure of John the Evangelist standing at the foot of the cross, lamenting Christ's suffering. He clasps his hands together in a gesture of deep grief and anguish. And if you look really closely at this gesture, and at the end of this part I'll give a reference as to where an image can be found, you'll see that it is almost identical to that expressed by Christ in Caravaggio's painting. It cannot simply be a coincidence. Caravaggio had almost certainly visited this pilgrimage site, saw this particular scene, and the hand gesture of John made such a strong impression upon him that when he came to consider how best to depict Christ in the painting commissioned by Ciriaco, he had a memory recall about that striking image and decided to make it a focal point of his painting. And it's possible that he discussed this with Ciriaco and Girolamo and sought their approval. And this powerful expression of self-denial and sacrifice is strengthened through its contrast with the gestures and expressions of Judas. Because Caravaggio, on one level, just like Giotto, presents a very straightforward comparison between the forces of good and evil. And so Caravaggio contrasts the pale, delicate, vulnerable, emotionally sensitive features of Christ with the rough and rugged, brutal and bestial, sunburned features of Judas. And so in that sense, Caravaggio presents the traditional view of Judas as represented by the gospel writers, a man who betrayed Christ because he was possessed by the devil and motivated by greed. And yet, on the other hand, like Giotto, and even more so, he presents us with a more subtle and nuanced interpretation of Judas's character. Because the trouble with this black and white approach is that it totally ignores the fact that Judas couldn't live with himself for having betrayed an innocent man. So he threw away the silver coins and took his own life. And I think, partly because Caravaggio was a man himself of so many contradictions, that he, more than any other artist, knew that this demanded a much more subtle and sensitive handling and presentation of Judas's personality. And that is precisely what Caravaggio gives us, which is arguably the most psychologically complex study of Judas's character in the history of art. As soon as Christ flinches at Judas's kiss and turns his head away, he reveals by these actions his foreknowledge of Judas's betrayal, and we see Judas's reaction to this. His face is a picture of guilt, remorse, fear, and self-loathing. Even were Christ to look him in the eye, as Giotto's Christ does, he would not be able to return the gaze. For he's looking beyond Christ, staring wildly into space, like a man tormented by the irreversible nature of his actions. That haunted look suggests that he can see ahead into his own future and the gruesome death that awaits him. And that expression also makes clear to us that he knows there is now no turning back, no way of reversing the action he has taken. And yet, ironically, he seems desperate to do just that. Clinging with his left hand onto the left arm of Christ, as though his life depended upon it, as though he's trying to protect Christ from arrest by the soldiers, whom he has brought to this spot for that very purpose. Seeing this as an obstruction, the soldier in the foreground pushes Judas's hand away as he moves forward to apprehend Christ. The contradictory nature of Judas's actions reflect the confused, tormented, agonized state of his mind, a state that will drive him to suicide. Well, this is all very powerful stuff, psychologically, emotionally draining. And we've still got the soldiers and the lantern bearer to consider. So I think it's a good idea if we take a break now. And in the fifth and final part of this podcast, we'll look at the rest of the characters in the painting. And I'll also tell the fascinating story of the more recent history of the painting and how it came to be acquired by the National Gallery of Ireland in Dublin. Before I sign off, let me give you, as promised, the reference material for a very good image of St. John the Evangelist in the crucifixion scene in the chapel at Varello. I came across this image on a documentary that I watched on YouTube called The Taking of Christ, The Private Life of an Easter Masterpiece, which was made in 2009 by Fulmar TV for BBC Wales. The documentary is superb and worth watching in full, but if you want to save time for the purposes of this podcast, the image of St. John's hands is shown around 9 minutes into the documentary. Well, thank you so much if you have been listening to all the parts of the podcast so far. I really appreciate that. And I hope very much you enjoy your company for the fifth and final part of the series. So until then, take care, stay safe, and have a wonderful week. Goodbye.